From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Donald Trump and Mike Pence are in Pence's home state of Indiana to detail what they're offering Carrier to keep about 1,000 of the 2,100 jobs the company planned to move to Mexico in Indiana. The deal's a feather in the cap of the Trump-Pence team. It's a sigh of relief for those 1,000 workers. But it's also a concern for economists. Those jobs are just a fraction of the over 150,000 manufacturing jobs lost in Indiana since 2000. And there are other manufacturing jobs unfilled. Michael Hicks is director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University. Michael, your reaction to the deal when you heard it?
Well, of course, I'm pleased for the workers, but I think as a long-term strategy, some of the things that underlie the decision of firms to relocate or to change operations are going to have to be addressed in a way that simply deal-making isn't going to cut it.
Well, for instance?
Well, I think the bigger problem that Carrier expressed in their announcement last spring was the cost of federal regulations. Surely a high corporate tax rate might incentivize a business to relocate to a place with lower tax rates. You know, but even with the trade issue overhanging all of this, the bigger issue is that somewhere between 8 and 9 jobs are lost to automation for every 1 job that's lost due to trade.
We hear this over and over again, that it's not about trade as much as it's about the changing face of manufacturing. And we were struck with reporting about the Carrier workers in particular. These are workers who make over $20 an hour with benefits, with just high school diplomas. But as manufacturing work moves into more and more automation and computer-driven machinery, you're going to need more training than that.
Oh, you know, to be sure, the Carrier factories, both in Indianapolis and Huntington, are, to speak honestly, are yesterday's manufacturing jobs. They're assembling a 50-year-old technology with a very expensive workforce. The real challenge for American manufacturing, which, by the way, is having nearly a record year on top of a record year in 2015, is how they maintain a workforce that is able to handle the new automation, you know, workers that can handle statistical process control, who can do very precise calculations, and then can troubleshoot a very advanced technology. That's the challenge, not the, you know, low wage pressure from Mexico on some of these types of operations.
So this would seem to be a critical issue. We're understanding that almost 50% of people in Indiana who work only have a high school diploma.
Right. And you know, Indiana's educational attainment has long been of significant worry to the manufacturing trade groups. It's not just a problem of Indiana, of course.
Right.
It's that way through the Midwest and the industrialized South. But the challenge is not how do we keep these jobs, but how do we take the men and women who work there and prepare them for the jobs of the future. So an announcement like this, as pleasing as it surely is, doesn't represent a sustainable path to employment for the state.
Well, we understand even now, though, Indiana has an unemployment rate below the national average. So people right now are working.
Right now, we've had a really fabulous 4 years in the Indiana economy. The unemployment rate now is at full employment. It's hard to find workers anywhere. Just manufacturing jobs in the Indianapolis area, there are many thousand job openings right now on any of the online job posting boards. So the real challenges that Indiana face are being having an enormous amount of resources and focus dedicated to them. Mike Pence, to his credit, returned vocational education opportunities to Indiana high schools. And that's beginning to show some merit. The challenge is that the kids who aren't going off to college are those that are already facing the deepest academic difficulty. And mm-hmm. So that's not really what modern manufacturers are looking for.
Well, we're already hearing from other companies in Indiana. The Manitowoc, I hope I'm saying that correctly, food service factory, which is going to close. They've said, we'd love to hear from the Trump administration. Your thoughts on an administration, albeit with the governor of the state, inserting the federal government into one company's future?
Right. It's hard to overstate how little the deal-making that seems to dominate the media matter. So if the Trump administration does this every day for the next 4 years, that's equivalent to about 6 months of job gains. So it's not a sustainable economic strategy, but a sustainable economic strategy would be to use this opportunity and leverage this example into doing things with tax policy, with infrastructure development, and I think very importantly with federal regulatory climate that would help lots of jobs stay, not just 1,000 at a time.
That's Michael Hicks, director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University. Professor Hicks, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Well, the FBI is investigating whether the man who drove his car into pedestrians before getting out and attacking people with a butcher knife at Ohio State University on Monday has ties to radical Islamic groups. The attacker, 20-year-old Abdul Razak Ali Artan, a Muslim Somali refugee, was killed by police at the scene. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack, and yesterday President-elect Trump tweeted, "ISIS is taking credit for the terrible stabbing attack at Ohio State University by a Somali refugee who should not have been in our country." Hassan Omar is the director at the Somali Community Association of Ohio in Columbus. He joins us by Skype. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what have things been like at your office and for Somalis in the U.S. Since the attack on Monday?
Like all of us, the Somali community was deeply shocked and saddened by the event when individual Somali committed a senseless attack against students and faculty of the Ohio State University. We condemn this attack in the strongest possible terms, and I hope to send a message that the Somali community here in Ohio stands with all Americans against any violence, hatred. Since the mid-1990s, Somali Columbus has been the home, peaceful, and Somali community have been a law-abiding community. And we want our neighbors, our friends, our classmates, and our colleagues to know that we are here to be part of the Americans. We hope that you do not judge our entire community by the action of one individual.
Well, it was one individual this week, but there was also a Somali who was responsible for that knife attack in Minnesota back in September. What do you think's going on here that we've now had two Somalis that appear to have been radicalized and have carried out attacks in the U.S.?
We believe that the Somalia have been in a civil war for so long, and the United States actually been involved since 1992 when the American troops went to Somalia. And America saved millions and millions of Somalis during the starvation, the Operation Restore Hope. Most of the people who leave this country are the people who survived for that starvation. And when we came to the United States, we get a lot of opportunities. In terms of economic development, and we'll get economic educational opportunity, employment, and we gain a lot of, we created a lot of businesses. Thousands of Somali kids get graduated college, and we get an unlimited opportunity that we get for this country. We are not ungrateful people, we are grateful people. So we are American and we are here. And
so what do you think happened then? Why do you think there have been two attacks by Somali Americans in the last few months?
This is something that really everybody's wondering and shocked, because these kids, they grew up in a refugee camp. They came to the United States. They get an education. They get whatever. So really, we do not understand. The other thing is that ISIS is an organization that claims everything, happiness. When they recognize the person has a Muslim name, they want to take a credit of it. And they are not really know what they are talking about when it comes to the young man who live in Ohio and came refugee camp and get educated. So we really don't understand why these kids are committed that crime. And this is, we don't want the people to see us as a collectively, we are behind this. This is not a common decision made by the community. This is based on an individual, and he get killed. He paid the price. And, you know, we don't want the other community to be, you know, get a stigma or also to paint it on us or blame on us. So Somali community has been shocked, saddened, and we are the people who really scared the most.
Well, what do you think of Donald Trump's comments? He said that this Somali refugee should never have been in our country.
We would like to tell him that we are a business-minded community. We are a peaceful community. We are a hardworking community. And also, we want to let you know that the Somalis are not 100 million or 100, you know, this is a very small community who are very vulnerable, very, you know, need support. And we would like to work with the law enforcement and anybody who wants to help, you know, find out the problems. And we should not be separated from the rest of the community. I've been voting for the last 17 years. I'm a U.S. citizen. And, you know, my mother's here. My brothers are here. My children are here. My wife's here. And I'm not allowing somebody to set a fire in my house.
That's Hassan Omar, who is the director at the Somali Community Association of Ohio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And today is the anniversary of the first draft lottery in the U.S. since the Second World War. Here's how it sounded on December 1st, 1969.
Because of the CBS News special report which follows, Mayberry RFD will not be presented tonight, but will return next week at its regularly scheduled time over most of these stations. The Draft Lottery, a live report on tonight's picking of the birth dates for the draft.
Here and then, numbers corresponding to dates were pulled from a big bowl and read out. Where your birth date was in this lottery could determine whether or not you went to Vietnam. Let's back up. In 1969, all young men had to register for the draft when they turned 18. They still do, but back then, all had to serve unless they received exemptions, like going to college, which people began to realize was incredibly classist. Not everyone could afford college. In the late 60s, the unpopular Vietnam War was escalating. Thousands of young men were coming home in caskets. The Nixon administration wanted to move to a volunteer military and expand the pool of recruits, so the draft lottery was instituted, dates called out on live television.
February 14th.
It was a lottery that felt like a Hunger Games for 18 to 26-year-olds. If your number was low, there was a good chance you'd be drafted unless you could find a deferment like grad school or bad feet. At one fraternity house at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, one young man super glued boots to his feet for months to try to get a deferment. He was at one of the animal houses, you know, like the movie. But in real life, at least some members of Herrett House went from beer-soaked party animals to sober activists concerned about an unpopular war and an unfair system that had protected them from military service. One of them was Dennis O'Neill, now a screenwriter and journalist. We spoke in 2013 when he'd written a fictional account of his time at Dartmouth, Whiplash, when the Vietnam War rolled a hand grenade into the animal house. It was based on true accounts of some Dartmouth grads who were coming back in body bags. Not all sought deferment. Dennis also started a website for others to share their memories of where they were when their number was called in the lottery. And at the time, we asked Dennis, what was the mood on this day in 1969 on campus?
Well, a lot of foreboding, needless to say, because Dartmouth had been pretty much a road trip culture, a lot of Animal House shenanigans. But at this point, all of a sudden, for seniors, you know, after 3 years of protective custody at Hanover, New Hampshire, you're looking at the very real possibility of going to Vietnam, getting called up if you drew a low draft number. So there was a lot of anxiety that year, first class ever to graduate with a diploma and a draft number.
Well, even as you say this, it reminds us also of the culture war that was ignited around this, because there were a lot of people who weren't privileged enough to go to college who were serving, who were marching down to the draft board because they didn't have exemptions.
Well, that was true, Robin. And I think actually one of the reasons why they put the lottery in was an attempt to correct the imbalance. I think that's one of the driving reasons behind the draft lottery, that it would make it more equitable. And ironically, after the draft, it actually turned more students against the war.
How did this draft lottery work?
Well, it was surreal, for one thing, because it looked like a bingo match, you know, low tech. It took place at Selective Service Headquarters. General Hershey was in charge, and they literally put 366, a leap day, numbers representing a day of the year in blue capsules and put them all into a big fishbowl. And they were pulled out by different people. That night, it turns out, Dartmouth was playing Norwich Military Academy in a hockey game. And so most of the evening for me was taking place on the ice in this very surreal atmosphere where the fraternity brothers with transistor radios were shouting out the draft numbers as the seniors would look up from the ice, from the puck, into the stands. I didn't realize till much, much later what the score of the game was, because the bigger game that night was being played in the stands and was being broadcast from Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Young women crying because they were thinking of their boyfriends, their brothers, families, parents gathered around TV sets. This was a national—I mean, I mentioned Hunger Games. It feels like Hunger Games. Everybody was watching.
Well, I think everybody my age remembers exactly where they were, and every fraternity at Dartmouth went into a bunker mode, and the televisions were dragged up into the living rooms, and everybody set up basically a mock draft, and the names of the seniors were put up on billboards, and as the numbers were pulled out, you know, there would be a sigh of relief or a moan or a groan. And I never forget after that night, Robin, I'm sure everybody had a similar memory of that night when your number finally was called. I was 163, which wasn't good. But this scene in the basement of Herod House, we repaired there, and on the bar top was this kid from Coleraine, Minnesota, Kent Nyberg, and he had drawn number 366. The leap day, and he was not going to war, and he had bought the keg for the house, and he had basically drunk himself into a happy stupor. And on the other side of the room was this kid from Maine, and he'd drawn number 14, and he was sobbing uncontrollably, and he was being consoled by his girlfriend. But those two images that night in the basement of Herod, after December 1st at Dartmouth, really, and on any other campus in America, it became a tale of two campuses. If you drew the low number, you were either going to war or you had to figure out how to get out of the war. And if you drew the high number, you were home free.
Let's listen to some of the accounts that you're getting at your website, whiplashthebook.com. Let's listen.
My lottery number was 18. I was a dead man walking.
Ultimately, I ended up being number 280, totally in the safe category.
As it turned out, my number was 354, and I was relieved, to be honest, but I couldn't be very joyous about it.
It's photojournalist James Nottway. Before him, filmmaker Bill Idalot, composer Mason Daring. Dennis O'Neill, talk about the culture war aspect of this, because many of the college students, when they got low draft numbers, then started frantically trying to get a deferment. And they knew doctors, their dads had connections. You got a deferment. But many blue-collar kids couldn't. The college kids had been protected.
But we were protected. We were sheltered, you know, under the university umbrella. And for me, I was conflicted because both of my parents had fought in World War II. They were in the OSS. But my dad was completely dead set against this war. And he would stand in front of the flagpole in Westport, Connecticut, my hometown, every Sunday morning in silent protest to the war. And he knew that the generals were lying, and he knew that it was the wrong war. And so he encouraged me to do whatever I would have to do to avoid going over there. But I felt guilty about it because I knew others were going.
Well, you described some of the things that people did. They ate to gain yes. gain weight. The fellow who put boots on for months it's just disgusting. Some took drugs. What were some of the other things?
Well, there was a whole range. You know, at Dartmouth, the fraternities became bunkers of draft evasion. And one boy started eating mac and cheese. He would go down to the big box store and get like a 50-pound chunk of cheddar and then, you know, massive bags of noodles. And he just started eating. He put on 50 pounds. He had an idea that if he could eat enough, he would get out for obesity, which he did. The boy who put the super glue on his boots ended up with a pretty good mushroom patch when he opened up those boots in Manchester.
At the draft board.
Hypertension.
Yeah,
at the draft board. And of course, as we know, eventually the street protests had an effect and helped bring the war to a close.
Well, the other thing that helped with kids who were getting exemptions at draft boards is that many of the doctors who were doing the exams agreed.
The chief medical officer at Manchester was a young guy, radiologist from La Jolla, California. He was happy to see as many kids get off as possible. It was just the luck of the draw at that draft board.
But I'm hearing that, but I can't help but thinking of the young men first of all, there were young men who wanted to go, but the young men who may not have wanted to go and really had none of these choices.
That's absolutely right, Robin. And I felt a burden, really, in taking the train back from New Haven to Bridgeport. You know, they were tough neighborhoods that I went through, and I knew that those kids you know, were serving in my place. But I also knew that some Dartmouth kids had gone and given their lives as well. So it wasn't a good assignment for anybody. Mm. But because I felt privileged, I felt that fate had intervened and I had gotten out, and that maybe because of that I should try to make something of myself. I tried to turn it into a crossroad in my life that made me be a little more grateful for what I had and possibly head off in a useful direction.
No more Animal House. Well, but meantime, what do you want people to do now?
Well, I think it's a useful conversation to have, especially when we have a country that seems to be perpetually involved in one war or another. You know, whether a draft would be useful to help deter some of that warfare, or whether some sort of national service would be useful. But I think when you go back and you remember, and I think when you have a conversation about the draft and what it meant and who went and who didn't go and who didn't come back and who came back in a body bag, it kind of usefully advances the conversation about this seemingly perpetual war footing that we're on these days.
Well, it's also a reminder of a night when everyone was glued to television or radio trying to hear their number.
And Robin, what was so interesting when we thought about it is how fate had intervened. What if you were twins and one of you was born a minute before midnight and the other 2 minutes after midnight? One got the low number, one got the high number. There was so much fate involved in it. And no matter what you had done in your life up until then, it didn't matter. They pulled this ball out of a fishbowl in Washington, D.C., and because of that, your life changed dramatically.
Yeah. Dennis, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
The latest research from Gallup shows there's one factor that has led half of all workers to quit a job at some point. Any guesses? It's that they don't like the boss. Kurt Nickisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review, which has published advice for employees who are not getting along with a boss. Kurt, welcome back.
Hey, thank you.
And tell us about this problem. What are some of the things that bosses do that employees don't like, or what sours the relationship?
It all seems like common sense, right? We all kind of know it, but if you get into these bad patterns with your boss where maybe you get an email late at night and you're angered by that, and so then you don't respond to it right away and the boss thinks that you're slow to sort of respond to that, like we get into these unwanted repetitive patterns, and those things just end up kind of souring a relationship, and it takes a lot of effort to turn that around.
And impacting your work?
Oh, absolutely. So it's interesting in this Gallup research looking at employee engagement, that's a big factor in just firm performance, the performance of your company, but also just your satisfaction with work. The people who are engaged with their work, there's a strong correlation to describing their managers in positive terms. So it has so much to do with just how much meaning and satisfaction, you know, we get out of our jobs.
So what's some of the advice of what you should do to improve a bad relationship with your boss?
Yeah, there are a number of things, but one of those is actually to start thinking about your boss more and thinking about yourself a little bit less. So actually practice empathy, because the fact is there are tons of bad bosses. They're not always bad people. They're often good people who are simply making mistakes because they don't have experience or training, or they are overwhelmed by demands from their bosses. And so if you can just try to put yourself in your boss's shoes, your bad boss's shoes, try to figure out why they're being the way they are, that can actually go a long way to helping you adjust to that.
And if that doesn't work, people may be surprised to hear that the next step may be, quote, organize a mutiny.
Yeah, so this is the last step, I think, before leaving the company. You can think more about your own role in the relationship. You can offer a chance for the boss to change. There are ways to do that. But yeah, organizing a mutiny is a serious thing when it really is the bad boss who's bringing you down, but also the unit, the company, and it's in the company's interest to remove that boss. Then you can go to HR, but you better have pretty serious documentation, and you need to know that it's going to work.
Yeah, because it could backfire.
And so you may end up leaving the company or the organization anyway, but you'll have hurt your career at the same time.
So do people end up mostly leaving or solving the problem and making it work with the boss?
You know, a lot of people live with it too long. So I think there's a lot of merit in realizing that there are steps you can take to change the relationship. But then if in the end, if you can't do that, You know, it's not your fault that you have a bad boss, but it is your fault if you stay too long and you start getting kind of downtrodden by this whole experience working with the same person over and over again and not having it work well. So, yeah, leave the company. And that's often a sign to companies that, you know, this boss actually may be a problem.
And interestingly, we said half of all employees in the U.S. have quit jobs at some point in their careers to get away from their bosses. Turns out the numbers are even higher for workers in basically the entire rest of the world. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. We'll link you to more about this at hereandnow.org. Kurt, thanks.
My pleasure.
President-elect Donald Trump kicks off what he's calling a thank you tour tonight with a campaign-style rally in Cincinnati, an unusual move after an election, but so much of the Trump transition has been unusual. Michael D'Antonio has been following Trump for years. He's author of The Truth About Trump, and he joins us from New York. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you.
And what's jumped out at you about the Trump transition, which has been so unusual as transitions go?
Well, what really jumps out at me is that he's very much the same Donald that I knew back in 2014. He's going to proceed in an idiosyncratic way. You know, this sort of parade of people coming to visit him where there's really a lot of stagecraft involved, whether it's at the country club where he stands a few steps above others and greets them, or they're trooping into Trump Tower. He's always putting himself in the best light as he would find it. And, you know, the rest of us may not expect this of a president-elect, but he's playing the game the way he's always played it, showing himself in the best light and trying to have the kind of power advantage in all of these exchanges. So we're getting the real guy here. There's no different Donald Trump emerging in the transition.
What do you think about Mitt Romney in particular and how that's played out? You mentioned, you know, people parading into his home in Bedminster, New Jersey. Mitt Romney probably most famously, and then out to dinner with him at Jean Georges in New York. And yet he's got his staff out there on television saying he shouldn't pick Mitt Romney for Secretary of State. What's that all about?
Well, you know, this is a guy who ran saying that he was going to be independent of the usual ways of doing things. And the ones who are putting the knock on this exchange with Romney are actually longtime political folks like Newt Gingrich and even Kellyanne Conway, his campaign manager. These are people that have been in the swamp, as Donald would call it, for their whole careers. So I have a feeling that this is something that the people who voted for Trump like. I think he's consistent with the character he presented on the campaign trail. And I think if he picks Mitt Romney, he's going to get enough support for that decision for it to be politically advantageous.
And what do you think about all the tweets? You know, he's got people coming into his office to meet with him about very important jobs. And in the morning, he's tweeting about flag burning, or he's tweeting about people voting illegally, something that, by the way, has been proven to be not true.
Well, there's nothing surprising about this. If you consider who Donald has always been, he's loved to go past the normal mediators. So he doesn't want to be communicating through a press conference. He wants to go directly to his social media followers. And these tweets, I think, are actually planned out in his head. I don't think it's as spontaneous as folks might think. He knows that he wants to get attention for a point of view. So the flag burning issue wasn't something drawn out of the news, but it was something that he thought would appeal to a certain red meat base of his, and I think it works. The more people tell him not to do something and then he does it anyway, the stronger he appears to the people who are fond of the Trump image. And, you know, he's playing this game that he almost can't lose. And I think that's something we all have to pull back and look at. It doesn't matter that there are no facts to base a claim about fraudulent votes by the millions. That's not the point. The point is that Donald is making a claim and he's pressing a point of view and getting attention for it. Whether it's true or not, I really think isn't important to him, and I'm not sure it's important to the people who voted for him.
Is it important to him if saying something like that undermines the democracy that he is going to be leading?
Well, that's an important issue. You know, you and I might really be concerned about whether democracy is imperiled by this kind of behavior, and certainly coming from someone else, it might be taken more seriously. If Barack Obama went around saying that there's a terrible problem with the voting rolls and they need to be examined really carefully, people might become alarmed. But Trump has trained us to not take him seriously. And I think that is a fascinating phenomenon. I think it is dangerous. Don't get me wrong. As he becomes the actual president of the United States, if he continues this kind of behavior, there's going to be a big pushback, and there should be, because ultimately our democratic process and our institutions need to be protected, and it requires the president's serious consideration.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Trump biographer Michael D'Antonio. And Michael, I wonder how much power you think Trump's cabinet appointees will have, people like Betsy DeVos for education or Wilbur Ross for commerce or Steven Mnuchin for Treasury. Are they going to be able to make decisions independently of Trump, or is he going to micromanage?
Oh, he won't micromanage. I think he's going to give them big portfolios and expect them to act independently, along with guidelines that he sets, of course. So if he's saying he's going to make America great again and the Secretary of Transportation is going to invest in infrastructure and that makes America great again, I'm not sure he cares about the details. And the other thing that they can have confidence in is that he'll support them even when they're under attack, because he's not going to want to say that he made a mistake appointing them in the first place. Hmm. So if Mitt Romney is having second thoughts about this, I think he might imagine more realistically that he would be a pretty powerful Secretary of State because Donald knows he needs the help.
So if he's going to give those people so much power, why do you think so many of them are establishment Republicans, given that the establishment didn't really support him? He doesn't owe the establishment much at all.
No, he doesn't. But I think he's probably a little bit intimidated by the prospect ahead of him. I believe that Trump was as surprised as anyone that he won. And I'm not sure that he was preparing to serve as president of the United States during the campaign. So he recognizes that there's expertise he requires. And if someone appears to be going too far down the traditional path and corrupt Washington, as he would say, he can rein them in. But he values competence.
Do you think that he will actually disconnect himself from his business as he said he would?
I think he'll appear to disconnect himself. You know, whether he is truly disengaged will be hard to tell. Even if he has his children engaged in this and running it officially, I can't believe that he's not going to be curious about what's happening and that he's not going to tote up, as time passes, the extra billions of dollars that accrue to the Trump bottom line by virtue of him being president of the United States.
Michael D'Antonio, after all the time that you have spent with Donald Trump and studying Donald Trump, what can you tell us about what you think he could bring to the presidency that will be transformative or surprising?
Well, I think that he's going to be willing to draw from the left and the right. And you can see this in his own history. Donald has been a Democrat, an independent, and a Republican. He has been pro-choice and he's been pro-life. He's held almost every position you can imagine on almost every issue. But that means that he's going to be open to solutions that come from any direction. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him promote a lot of deficit spending and a big infrastructure program, bigger than what Barack Obama managed to get through the Congress in 2009. And on the other hand, he could be very conservative when it comes to education, as his education secretary choice seems to indicate, and push for vouchers and charter schools on a much grander scale than we've seen before. But I wouldn't expect him to be doctrinaire across the board, and I wouldn't be surprised to see him borrow ideas from the left as well as the right.
And do you think he'll continue to tweet throughout his presidency?
I think that'll get scaled back. You know, even Donald Trump is affected by the gravity of the presidency, and we may see a lot less tweeting.
That's former Newsday reporter Michael D'Antonio, who is a Donald Trump biographer. His latest book is called The Truth About Trump. Michael, thanks again.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And here we are once again, World AIDS Day, the 28th. It's a day to reflect on the 35 million people who've died from the disease, support those living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, and reevaluate efforts to stop its spread, a big concern. There's still no cure or preventive vaccine for HIV, although there's a major new anti-HIV vaccine trial underway in South Africa. More than 5,000 at-risk volunteers are participating, and we should know how effective that vaccine is within the next few years. But meanwhile, let's check in with Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
And where are we? When we spoke a while back, there was a concern here in the U.S. that younger people in particular were not as cautious about sexually transmitted HIV or transmissions by needles. There seemed to be a forgetfulness about this. So where are we? Are there new cases in the U.S.?
Oh, certainly. We have a problem in the United States that has not really substantially changed, that we have approximately 40,000 new infections each year in the United States, and that is predominantly among African-American men who have sex with men, and among that group, younger people. So we still have that situation where we have not been able to crack that level of getting down substantially below 40,000 new cases and new infections of HIV per year. So we need to implement some of the things that are available, such as pre-exposure prophylaxis and a variety of other prevention modalities.
Go back. Pre-exposure prophylaxis.
Okay, so there are more than a couple of ways that you could prevent infection. One of the important ones is a thing called treatment as prevention, where if you treat individuals who are infected and you get the level of their virus to below detectable level, you dramatically diminish the likelihood that they are going to infect their sexual partners. Mm. In addition, if you get someone who's uninfected, who is at high risk, practicing high risk behavior despite attempts to cut down on that, there is an approach called pre-exposure prophylaxis, which means you give the individual a single pill which contains two antiretroviral drugs, even though that person is not infected. If they take that pill every day, a number of studies have shown if you adhere to the regimen, you can very dramatically diminish the risk of getting an acquisition of infection by well over 90%.
Yeah, well, and you know this because while there are still many more cases than anyone would like, new HIV infections have fallen over the last decade.
Well, yes, but they've hit this plateau, and that's the problem. We can't be sort of lulled into complacency because if you look at new infections during the really bad years of HIV, there were as many as 120,000, 140,000 per year. They went down dramatically, hit around 40,000, but have now stayed at that level. The demography is different. It's now, as I mentioned, very disparate towards African-American men who have sex with men. We still have other risk groups that get infected, but they're disproportionately more infected.
Well, what else has to happen there, though? Is that education? I mean, we've also talked about how in certain African-American communities, there's still a stigma about homosexuality. Is that a part of this?
Well, absolutely. Stigma is a part of it. We have to diminish the stigma to get people to feel comfortable with coming out and getting tested. And getting tested is critical to so many aspects of addressing the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the United States and even globally. We've got to implement the tools that we have, and we have very good tools to treat and to prevent HIV infection.
Dr. Fauci, here we are, the 28th World AIDS Day, and of course the epidemic was, you know, years before that. So we're decades into this. As I always do every AIDS Day, I want to point people to the Los Altos story. Just Google it. It's the work of a Rotary Club in Northern California that got together to try to tackle this issue. They're now working, you know, across Africa. let's look a little at the positive side. You know, how many people have become energized to try to do something? What would you like to point people to?
Well, what I'd like to point people to is to, first of all, eliminate stigma, because stigma gets in the way of getting people into the programs that we know work. If you look at the infections just taken in the United States, 12% of the people don't know that they are infected, yet they account for transmitting about 30% of all the infections in the United States. Importantly, the people who are infected know they're infected but are not in an adequate care program. Those individuals are responsible for transmitting about 62 to 63% of all the infections. So if all you did was to identify, test everyone who's infected, get them into an adequate program of care and treatment, you could actually theoretically and truly eliminate more than 90% of the infections in the United States. So remove stigma, get people tested, and get them into the proper programs of either prevention or treatment.
That's Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, thank you so much.
It's good to be with you.
And again, because it's amazing, 40,000 new HIV infections every year. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.